Well, you know what? A lot of us, I don't know if your holiday was different than mine, but, you know, a lot of us, we got gift cards, we got different things, and maybe you didn't get what, you know, you have a great book that you heard about. There's all of this best of stuff. Maybe there's a great book out there. Well, and on top of that, there's also kinds of new books that are out at this time of year. Well, what better way to use that card or to just buy a present for yourself.
Which people do during the holidays.
That's
too.
Right. Absolutely. It's to go to an independent bookstore and to pick up a great volume. James Conrad of the Golden Notebook has been keeping track of literary pursuits worth our time, and it's a great pleasure to have James with us. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Very nice to have you with us. You're the last bookseller of 2016, so you win. Congratulations.
I win. Thank you. Yes, and I hope you had a good holiday, too, and I thought you might get some more time off, but you did.
Well, no, we got four lovely days,
four days,
and then we've got the weekend coming up, so no, this, I'm not complaining. It's all
like
very
us,
nice.
Us retailers, we tend to, it's a mixed blessing for us at the holidays. We get a lot of great business, but we're a little tired.
Yeah.
Because we
it's all lovely.
Pretty hard during the time.
Absolutely. So where would you like
okay,
to begin?
Let's see. Well, it's kind of an odd time of year. There are most of the new books actually come out sort of earlier in December, and a lot of the other new books come out a little later in January. But I did pull together some things that I'm looking toward the new year and a little behind me for the new year,
for
the old year.
All fine.
Let's start looking back a little bit. Of course, our biggest issue of the year was the election, and that was the big thing on everybody's mind. And I don't mean to take any sides, but to put it diplomatically, there was definitely going to be half of the country a little unhappy about the outcome. And either way, and unfortunately, I fall on that losing side. So a few days after the election, I found myself, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners may have, unable to sort of move off my couch one day. And I was randomly changing TV channels, and I happened upon an airing of the documentary from the 80s, The Times of Harvey Milk. Now, that was the story of the first openly gay elected official in California. And keep in mind, this was in the 1970s when that happened. And his success at fighting down things like Proposition 6, which, you know, would have fired all the gay public school teachers. And ultimately, the whole thing ends with the tragedy of his assassination with Mayor Moscone by another San Francisco board supervisor, whose name I don't like to mention. And to sum up, by the end of the film, when they were showing the thousands of people in the Candlelight March, you know, memorializing, when you realize how this was certainly not the end of the gay lesbian rights movement after this horrible tragedy, and all the things that happened in the coming years, it kind of helps you get off your couch and to stop feeling sorry for yourself and to sort of move on, which brings me to my first book, which is How to Survive a Plague, The Inside Story of How Citizens and Science Tamed AIDS by David France. You might remember this was a documentary film a year or 2 years ago, I can't remember. It was nominated for an Oscar, and David France made this film, but now this is the book of it. And it's an incredibly readable and thoroughly detailed account of the AIDS epidemic and the AIDS activism movement that responded to the deadly crisis in the 80s and 90s. And like the Harvey Milk documentary, it's especially inspiring for those of us who are kind of defeated right now in our current political climate. France follows like three different threads in telling the story. The first is his own. He moved to New York as a newly out gay man right when the news articles first started to appear in the 80s about this gay cancer. And in another thread, he follows the activists who were from every walk of life. They were they were lawyers, they were teachers, they were in the arts. And they had to join in this movement because they found themselves living in a country that was doing absolutely nothing, and hundreds were dying around them. And they even had a president who wouldn't even say the word AIDS aloud after thousands had even died. And the third group he follows are the actual medical researchers, the ones who fought endless corporate and governmental red tape, as well as the same homophobia that their patients faced. It was, in fact, they were, in fact, a large part of this, as well as activists themselves who also became scientists and researchers and worked together with them to create conferences and studies internationally to help bring advancements to treatment and hopefully potentially cure the disease someday. Well, for all the AIDS, all the damage that AIDS did, it's important to remember how the activism that resulted from it created a whole new awareness of how you might deal with pharmaceutical companies now with drug pricings and all that, as well as drug trials. ACT UP brought to light the fact that, you know, trials tended not to factor in things like differences in gender and race. And they also taught the medical industry how to fast track certain drug trials so that people who really had no options and were potentially dying were able to actually get their hands on things earlier. So anyway, so for those of us a little devastated by the current political climate, I highly recommend David France's How to Survive a Plague.
I had an opportunity to interview David France a few days ago, and that conversation will air next Wednesday at 11:30, and we'll take up the half hour talking about his book and talking about, as you say, it's a very personal story as well, and it's very interesting. And he also talks about, obviously, the book came out right before the election, and he talks about his thoughts on what will happen as a result of the election.
Oh, that's great.
We'll have that conversation at 11:30. But in the meantime, it's a beautiful read.
It is. It's a great read. And also, he's also going to be at the Golden Notebook Martin Luther King weekend on Saturday the 14th at 6 p.m. and doing a video presentation. So don't miss that.
Great stuff.
On these similar lines, I just want to get in one other book that's similar to this, which is Cleve Jones's autobiography, When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. I know AMC did some stuff with Cleve, too. Jones grew up as a gay kid, literally living on the streets in San Francisco in the 70s, and got involved in politics through Harvey Milk's encouragement. And after Milk's assassination, Jones continued working with the community for their civil rights. And then also, he battled against AIDS, and he was instrumental in getting the AIDS quilt going, and he ended up being diagnosed himself. I just want to read a quick short passage from the autobiography, which kind of sums up everything I've been talking here about, which is, to quote, "It's easy to be overwhelmed by the challenges that face us. It is easy to be cynical and to despair. That is when I remember that the movement saved my life twice. First in 1971 as a frightened teenager when I learned of the gay liberation movement and flushed down pills I had hoarded to end my life. Then again in 1994 when I was dying of AIDS, the movement stormed the Food and Drug Administration, confronted the pharmaceuticals industry's greed, and exposed the shameful lack of government response. The movement gave me hope, and it is that hope that sustains me now, hope that we might yet save our planet and learn to share it all in peace, hope for justice and equality, and hope for the children that will follow us, that we may rise." And one last thing on Rising Up, also on Martin Luther King weekend, we are doing a big event called Hudson Valley Writers Resist. It's part of a nationwide thing through Penn. There's about 40 other groups doing this all throughout the country, and it's going to be at the Bear Theater in Woodstock. We'll have dozens of writers reading and some musicians doing sets, and it's celebrating, quote, "the power of words, compassion, equality, free speech, and democracy." And the event is in three sets at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and 4. Admission's free. And fundraising is going on at tables all throughout it to benefit the New York Civil Liberties Union, Planned Parenthood of the Mid-Hudson Valley, and Riverkeeper. And the Golden Notebook, of course, will be there selling books donated by authors.
Excellent.
Okay, let's get to some more books.
How about...
I presume a lot of you have an unfinished novel or proposal or screenplay or poem that's lying around. So for the new year, we have the book.
Yes, and they all write to the round table.
Well, then now you're going to finish them because we have a book for you called The Finishing School, The Happy Ending to That Writing Project You Can't Get Done by Carrie Tennis and Danielle Morton. Let's see. Like all good self-help books, this one actually tackles all the same things like, you know, doubt and judgment and fear. But what's unique is this book emphasizes organizing time. Carrie Tennis ran these groups online and also in actual groups called The Finishing School. And the point of it was for people to decide what it was exactly they wanted to accomplish in a month, as in like how many pages or how many chapters. And you would pull out your calendars and write down actual times for doing it. You were then given a partner in the class who would text with you. And you would basically text each other like, "I'm going to start writing now, my 2 o'clock time." And you'd text each other when you finished. This all sounds really kind of like silly, but if you're a writer at all, you really kind of are probably listening closely right now because you're like, this is actually the worst part of writing, is actually trying to sit down and set up the time to do it.
Right.
And this became a very successful thing for people to actually accomplish things because then you'd go back to the class and you'd discuss, you know, how much you got done in your allotted times and you got your work done. What's unique about it was these writing groups were not with people critiquing each other's work. It was very supportive and you were all there for each other, but you weren't critiquing each other and you were not creating like, you know, these little stars in the classroom, or some people, of course, were like, you know, the best writer there and you felt inadequate or all that. It was really just about scheduling and trying to support each other to achieve your goals. So that's your New Year's resolution if you have your unfinished book lying around.
Excellent.
And let's see. My next book is more for the soul. It's Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love by Brad Gooch. Gooch is a pretty well-known fiction writer, memoirist, done a lot of biographies, most notably his biography of Flannery O'Connor and Frank O'Hare. But with Rumi, he had to really reach back to the 13th century, and he did that by actually learning Persian. So he's a poet, a wonderful poet. He could actually translate Rumi himself to get a better understanding of him. And he traveled to places like Turkey and went to Iran and along the Silk Road to try to get a real sense of the environment of his subject.
Mm-hmm.
And he became, Rumi, as you probably know, has become really trendy in America. It amazes me how much we sell of Rumi every day of the week at Woodstock, actually. Of course, it's Woodstock. But still, he's very trendy. Anyways, the most interesting part about this wonderful biography is Rumi's relationship with the Shams of Trabitz, who is this mystic who is 20 years Rumi's senior. Rumi, at the time they met, was already this very well-respected Muslim preacher, but the Shams showed up and really transformed him into the mystic he became known for. It was a very intense and brief relationship and a little scandalous because they suddenly, like, you know, really sequestered themselves off to study together, and he welcomed the Shams into his life and even allowed his wife to unveil herself in front of him and all of this. And when the Shams left, Rumi sort of went mad, and that's when he became the celebrated mystic because he poured himself into his writing about the joys of reunion, of personal and divine, whether they happened or not. So if you're interested in Rumi and you have never read of him before, this biography is a wonderful way to start.
Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love by Brad Gooch. Next.
Next we have, if you're missing the whole nasty woman thing, let's try the biography of Victoria the Queen. It's by Australian journalist Julianne Bard. Queen's a little trendy right now. We have the success of the Netflix show The Crown that's been on. I don't know if you've followed that.
It's
absolutely wonderful.
I have one episode to go.
Oh, it's so good.
It really is.
It has my favorite line of the TV, of the whole TV year, which was when Philip catches her sort of using her power early on, and he says, "I see you've been queening around." It's like my favorite thing of the whole year.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now we have Victoria. She was actually interviewed, Julianne Bard, the journalist who wrote it, she was interviewed by The Guardian right after the election and sort of asked her to talk about Victoria and Clinton. And she admits that the idea for the biography actually began when Clinton lost to Obama in 2008, and which she pins really on gender. And she quotes in this interview, "I do wonder about the part of the strong queens of England that have played in the nation's psyche toward the acceptance of women in politics, and what kind of women. We've got Margaret Thatcher, we've got Theresa May, and yet today America still cannot vote for Hillary Clinton." I thought it was interesting that she kind of pins that the lack of having, you know, ultimate power females in America is part of our problem for actually getting one elected today. Anyway, she goes on to compare how tough and rude Victoria was and how she refused to accept defeat, which are some of the very things that seem to have offended, you know, Trump about Clinton, and that America possibly had issues with Clinton. I'm not saying Hillary Clinton was rude, but just being a tough woman seemed to not really resonate to some people. The resulting biography, it's a comprehensive and vibrant reading of history of one of the most successful leaders. After Albert had died, her husband, she went into this very deep period of mourning that England didn't think she'd ever recover from. But when she did recover, she actually recovered to such a degree that she became like a much stronger leader than she was when she was married to Albert. And she was very strong-minded, and she just allowed for all of the companionship. Her companionship with Scotsman John Brown, which she never married, this kind of scandalous relationship she had that she really could care less about, and she just kind of went on and did what she wanted. So that was Victoria the Queen by Julianne Bard, a beautiful biography.
Excellent. Next.
Okay, next we have, here's something for everyone. Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less by Soojun Kim Pang. Now, you got to kind of refer back to the Finishing School book, which, because I don't want you to just, like, give up working and not maintain your goals here, but definitely make
your
schedules.
Sounds like a good New Year's resolution.
Make your schedule and keep to them. But Pang is a Silicon Valley consultant and a scholar at Stanford, and he kind of believes that the amount of time you don't work is as important as the time you do work. Another thing he talks about with rest is rest doesn't actually just mean, you know, sleeping. He thinks rest is also things like, you know, vigorous exercise, you know, socializing with friends and family, all that. Some examples, which I think might make all of us feel better, are things like Charles Darwin used to take daily 4-hour strolls. Winston Churchill took daily naps. Bill Gates would go off for a week alone in a cabin and claim not to really be working at that time. And you would never really consider any of these people to be non-productive people. They accomplished major things that actually changed the world. So I think that as much as you want to stick to your schedules, you have to also, like if you think about writers that are famous writers that you love, if you look closely at their biographies, they tend to actually have these very dictated times they would write. Like Alice Munro would only write from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Dickens would only wrote five hours a day. And Garcia Marquez the same, and look how productive they were. But that's a lot of hours of the day that they weren't writing and that they were actually using in different ways as a way to keep their minds more healthy and to keep themselves more engaged in the world. So keep rest in mind. And also, one other quick word on rest is, which is part of this book too, there's a chapter on stopping, which I thought was great, and Hemingway kind of sums it up best is, and with writing especially, is know when to stop your work when you actually know exactly what's going to happen next, because that way, when you start up the next day, you obviously know where to start and you're not stuck with block.
We are out of time.
Oh, we're out of time.
But I want to let people know that they can see the complete list on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. They can also go to the Golden Notebook, of course, goldennotebook.com, or visit them. They're right on Tinker Street, for goodness sakes. James Conrad, Happy New Year to you. Thank you very much for being with us and for providing such a great list.
Happy New Year, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.